there's never been any real accountability by American office holders for, you know, illegal bombings on the other side of the world, or illegal campaigns of torture, or of a lot of the similar things that kind of go on the domestic front. And so I'm exploring in these books those ideas, and in Failed State in particular, like the idea of an American president being prosecuted for war crimes. And that idea, you know, I suppose is kind of covertly in conversation with real life a little bit, but that kind of principle applies regardless of who holds the office, even if we think the current regime is particularly heinous in that regard. Although there's an argument to be made that they're more like a kind of a lampoon version, and that a lot of the people that came before did a lot more worse things by any kind of objective measure.
Chris Brown returns to the Plutopia podcast discussing his latest novel, Failed State. Cory Doctorow called Failed State a novel that truly reckons with the enormity of both our climate emergency and the system that produced it. Chris joins John and Scoop in the virtual studio where we discuss Failed State, presidential accountability, lawyers and the law, food insecurity, urban wildlands, and much more.
Chris Brown is back with another book and a new conversation with Plutopia News. The new book, Failed State, continues the story of dystopian future lawyer Donnie Kimo, a good lawyer in a bad time. Donnie's a defense lawyer with a strong moral center in a very real world where you're not ever sure whether you're doing the right thing. Ethical ambiguity abounds. So, and that's like, Chris, I guess that's 8 years have passed, not since you wrote the last book, but since Donnie Kimo's last adventure.
Yeah, he kind of appears off stage in Tropic of Kansas as well, which takes place about 2 or 3 years earlier than this book. But yeah, 8 years since Rule of Capture, and sort of tying together the events of those last two books. But at the same time, a standalone book and story that you can read as a self-contained work and is designed to be read as such.
But Tropic of Kansas sort of falls in between the two.
Yeah, chronologically, and it's sort of the same world and broadly the same stories. The story of the society of that book, of the America of those books, is kind of this, you know, in continuity throughout. And there are some overlapping characters, but Tropic of Kansas is more of a kind of adventure story, whereas Rule of Capture and Failed State are just kind of a legal thrillers of a sort, lawyer stories mixed up with dystopian stories, or utopian, maybe.
Or ecotopian.
Ecotopian.
But we can get to that. Well, so I have a question about that 8-year period, or just the period in which, I mean, this imagined mythopoeisis kind of universe where these books are the stories in these books are happening, these narratives occur. Did you at some point along the way, either before or after writing any of the books, did you create kind of a whole like outline timeline? Are you working from something where you kind of know the whole period and know everything that happened along the way?
I mean, the short answer is no. For Tropic of Kansas, you know, which was the first of these books that I wrote, it was after I started working on the project that I realized it needed to be set in a kind of alternate version of the USA, because I wanted to write a story about basically a second American Revolution or a Civil War and a kind of popular uprising. And I concluded when I started working on that in, you know, 2012, 2013, that for that to be plausible, I needed to have a much more messed up version of America. So I did invent a whole backstory that included, like, you know, arcane nuggets like George H.W. Bush died in World War II, and so his son was never born. And, you know, and the stuff that's in the foreground there of Reagan being assassinated by Hinckley and Alexander Haig having been the vice president instead of Bush, and he becomes president and blah, blah, blah. And the Iranians killing the hostages and all that. But beyond that, you know, the, I mean, for each book, I kind of arrive at like the backstory that's important to the story that book wants to tell, if right. that makes sense. And I try to figure out, you know, ways to tie that in and continuity. But it's more about being true to the kind of the story you're trying to tell. Like with Rule of Capture, this backstory that hadn't been in Tropic of Kansas about the U.S. losing a war with China, which was important, I thought, to kind of set up the idea of this like nationalist resurgence and a kind of a like American Weimar period. For Failed State, we kind of have the prior two books, so you got a lot of the backstory there. But even there, I've invented some new elements that I hadn't discussed before.
One question that kept coming to mind with me as I read the book, and I feel that I have to ask you, why doesn't anybody like Donnie? He seems to be trying to do the right thing, and everybody's pissed off at him.
Well, you know, he's a lawyer, for starters. People have complicated relationships with lawyers, especially when it comes to trust in the veracity of what they say. As Donnie describes one of his better than him litigator buddies in Rule of Capture, you know, a really good trial lawyer can point at a dog and convince you it's a cat. And, you know, that produces a certain amount of a trust deficit. And, you know, and Donnie is kind of he's the kind of guy who has a knack for simultaneously having the noblest of intentions and the worst instincts and kind of some bad snap judgment. And, you know, and he's the kind of person who sometimes his uncompromising tendencies about what he thinks is the right thing to do can tick off his friends. And I think that's something that's true of a lot of, you know, people who get involved in deeply activist kinds of causes, including activist lawyers, where they become so uncompromising on some things that they tick people off for their inflexibility. And Donnie, you know, he likes to party. What can I say? And so, you know, and people who kind of get wasted at the wrong time sometimes disappoint their friends, as we've all encountered, and maybe some of us have occasionally done to our own friends. Who knows?
Indeed.
Right?
Well, you talk about the law, and the law of patents plays a key part in the story. And anyone from Texas is may be well aware of Marshall, Texas, the home of many patent trolls. How did you come to get involved with the patent story?
Well, that's a great question. Because that's an example of an element of the world of this book that I introduced really kind of late in the writing of it to better tell the story. Because the, you know, like a lot of the science fiction stories, I mean, this works as a character-driven novel, as a kind of a, you know, plot-driven page-turner where the plot kind of comes from the character. But there's also an idea layer of the book, you know. And the idea layer of this book is trying to dig into kind of deep ecology and issues around how do we get ourselves out of this Anthropocene conundrum we're in, wherein there are, without kind of going off too deep in the weeds on this, there are, there's a good argument to be made that we got completely off track, you know, with the agricultural revolution of the Neolithic, of the kind of, you know, the the story of the Fertile Crescent that we're all taught in, like, you know, third grade social sciences, and that, you know, that the permanent settlement of humanity into big cities around grain-based monocultures, that's the main reason, the main source of most of the ecological and political and economic injustices of modern life, and that the so-called barbarians of antiquity probably had it better off than us. So in the world of this book, we have food insecurity, kind of like we experienced a little bit ourselves this year. We're like, suddenly, you know, this idea that you can just kind of go to the store and get whatever you need anytime, suddenly it's like, oh, wait, that might not happen, right? As, you know, people start hoarding hand sanitizer and maybe even some food staples. And so in the world of this book, as I think is pretty plausible, climate change is a little bit more accelerated than it is for us, and it's produced a real crisis of the productivity of the agricultural heartland. And so all the smart techies and, you know, agronomists and agricultural engineers start patenting new hybrid seeds that can grow in these new conditions and maybe, you know, accelerate the carbon cleanup that plants do anyway. And so that idea, which is really prevalent right now, I mean, most of the farms in the Midwest where I grew up are now planted with patented seeds. You know, and you have like kind of like lawyers and their agents who go around the farms in the Midwest and probably all over Texas too to police the grain farmers to make sure they're not using outlaw seed. And so trying to just take on that idea of like, can you really, you know, attack the idea or interrogate the idea of being able to patent life, right? To patent the design for a living thing. And also to dig into the way in which, again, back to the Anthropocene conundrum, so much of the world, I mean, kind of almost all of the world around us, including many other species, has been reshaped in our image through domestication. That, you know, we have, you know, the last 10,000 years of planet Earth are the history of humankind controlling the reproduction of others, be it other species or other members of our own species, to produce the results we want, to generate the kind of economic surpluses we want.
It feels like you read Sapiens.
I have not read Sapiens. I read a book.
You actually just made one of the points of Sapiens.
Really?
You just said. Yeah.
Well, I read a book called Against the Grain by James C. Scott, who is a political scientist at Yale, and kind of like he's kind of a like almost anarchist in a way, who's an expert in the theory of the state. And so he decided to write a book about the kind of the origins of the state form of kind of human socio-political and economic organization, looking back to the earliest city states, specifically those of Mesopotamia, you know, the area around kind of around Basra in modern Iraq, you know, going back really like 6,500 years or so. And that's where, and he, you know, comes to these conclusions that in fact, you know, the old prevailing kind of consensus view among anthropologists and archaeologists and political scientists was that the formation of city-states was a big evolutionary step forward for humanity, right? That permanently settling in cities provided an abundance of wealth and prosperity and security for everybody, and that everyone was like happily migrating to these cities. And then you look at the new evidence that started to come out in the past 20 years, and it turns out like most of these permanent settlements actually followed the development of agriculture and were kind of an accidental byproduct of nomads just hanging out in biodiverse wetlands where there was lots of food. And then the rudiments of the state form just because of this power of accumulation of wealth, right? And then they, like, the guys who have the surplus, they have to go, like, enslave other people to do the agricultural work, to keep this thing going and to keep it growing. And that's like the basic trajectory of human history, and that all the so-called barbarians were mostly healthier, taller, longer living, and happier up until relatively recently.
Yeah, that's exactly what Harari is talking about. He says as long as we were nomadic and foraging, we were doing just fine. But as soon as we started like clinging to the land and doing agriculture, our diet got screwed up. We started eating bread all the time. You know, we couldn't move around anymore. We were sort of like tethered to specific spots, and it just sort of grew and evolved from there. And it's very interesting to kind of go back and look at that argument and think about that. It's sort of like we critique what we have now based on kind of being so completely in it. But to kind of go back to the origins and see where we started making wrong turns and mistakes, it's very enlightening, but it raises a lot of questions about how to move forward, I think.
Well, exactly. Very well said, John. And that's kind of what I'm trying to tackle in this book at the idea level, and what some of the characters are trying to tackle. And it's not an easy nut to crack, right? Like, okay, the bargain with Demeter was a bad deal. You know, the basic precepts of how we produce the food on which we survive through, you know, kind of production agriculture are kind of broken. And like, how do you engineer your way around that? I mean, you can't really. You can just try to like modulate the system we have. It's at least in any kind of, you know, on any kind of time frame that we could even get our heads around, right?
You've been writing a lot, Chris, about your own neighborhood, and the urban wilderness. And how much did your experience with your own urban wilderness area play into the book? Because there's some similarities, it seems, in the way the people in your book are trying to undo the damage of previous urbanization.
Yeah. That's right. And there's a big overlap, and really that, you know, my experience here over the past decade or so, in which I've been rehabilitating a brownfield in East Austin, and kind of a unique edgeland zone where you have sort of an abrupt transition between like light and even not so light industrial land uses and little pockets of kind of urban woods along the Colorado River, and on a lot where there used to be a petroleum pipeline running through that, where we built a home after getting the major oil company that had the pipeline to take out the remains. I've spent a lot of time, and even before then, you know, I've always kind of gravitated towards the urban woods. So I've been accumulating a lot of material and experience around, you know, the what that kind of, you know, kind of daily practice of like, it's experiencing the way wild nature manifests itself in the very heart of the city. And what that kind of teaches you about a lot of different things, from kind of our contemporary problems to, you know, the kind of way deep time will like express itself, like when you walk along the river and find, you know, Cretaceous fossils and, you know, Neolithic stone tools and, you know, arrowheads and settler plates and, you know, and the like skeletal discards and remains of recently living animals and, you know, and beer cans and trash and so many plastic bottles, you could, you know, make your own island out of them. You know, and really like even like writing Tropic of Kansas, the first of these three books, I set out to write what was more like a kind of post-cyberpunk novel of like internet-based direct democracy being realized, right? Of like, how do you like hack the Constitution for the age of the web, right? To create a more authentically participatory system. And as I dug into the world of that book and imagined these revolutionary conditions, I like realized partly through these, you know, walks around my crazy neighborhood in East Austin that most of the problems of the world of that book and of the real world, you know, which it mirrors, economic and social injustices, you know, the legacies of slavery, the legacies of the displacement and genocide of indigenous peoples, all of these things that are like kind of right here in plain sight, visible to us in contemporary urban Texas. They're all rooted in our kind of damaged relationship with the land. So each of these books tries to interrogate that in a different way. Failed State is trying to do so from a more like utopian angle of like, okay, like if those are the problems, like how can we fix them? And trying to envision a community of people who are going about that in a kind of autonomous zone, not unlike in some respects some of the ones we've seen popping up in real life this summer, and also not unlike, you know, some of the communal experiments we've seen in the American past, you know, including in the 60s and 70s.
So you have a character named Joyce. What is Joyce's vision of the future?
I mean, Joyce articulates a vision of kind of nihilistic hopefulness, if that makes any sense. It's, you know, there's a lot of paradox. It's just like this paradox of like, oh, we figured out what's wrong with civilization and how we got into this climate crisis, and it's basically insoluble and, you know, in any kind of foreseeable timeline, right? And her vision fundamentally is about trying to find a way to address those issues through like rewilding the city and kind of taking down a few pegs the human sense of primacy, endowing a legal system in which there are substantive rights and standing to protect those rights that are given to non-human things in the ecosystem, plants and animals, and trying to get a kind of truth and reconciliation, like real deeper justice for the, you know, centuries of ravaging of the kind of wild American continent that the European settlers found when they got here.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting what you were doing with New Orleans there. Why did you pick New Orleans for that settlement?
Well, partly because New Orleans was sort of where that was the territory that was ceded. It was kind of the contested territory or most contested territory in Tropic of Kansas. And so that's at the end of Tropic of Kansas, after there's this uprising, the kind of most radical rebels are ceded that territory. Partly because in the world of these books, it's like already so trashed. And that's true with a lot of like efforts by people to kind of create new sovereign territories, is that it's usually like you got to go to the like the mega brownfields, the toxic zones. Those are the places that the, you know, the established states are like, yeah, you can take that. And it also works well as a kind of a great like, you know, climate crisis laboratory, is a city that, you know, is basically mostly below sea level, right? A city that really wants to be a big bowl of water. You know, we've kind of engineered into a tenuous existence, as we've seen in, you know, recent memory. And it's a city I lived in, you know, I know it well, I went to college there, and it's a cool city to kind of provide an American experiment, because it is such a unique outlier in the American system. It's got its own kind of weird deep history and a kind of history of difference, if you will, and that's kind of fun to play with. And so, and it's just cool as like an apocalyptic vision of like, it's a great place to take that aesthetic of like, think of all those like 70s apocalyptic dystopias where, you know, people emerge from the domed city and they find the like ruins of the past, of our present, right? Covered in green vegetation. And like looking at those kinds of images and saying, oh, actually, maybe that isn't dystopia. Maybe that's like heaven, right? To see, you know, New York or Washington or New Orleans, you know, the central business district or whatever, you know, covered in vegetation and retaken by nature.
You chose New Orleans to be heaven. How did you come to make the decision to make Dallas the other part?
Well, you know, the Rule of Capture and Failed State are, they're also Texas stories. Rule of Capture took place in Houston, and I like to think did a pretty good job of like capturing a lot of the essence of Houston through this kind of wacky dystopian mirror. And Dallas is another city I've spent a lot of time as a, you know, as a working professional in Texas. And it's a great kind of like counter utopia. I mean, it's sort of dystopian, but to the people who live there, at least the ones on top, it's like, it doesn't get any better. It's a city of like corporate sovereignty. And I think, you know, I think that's like true of Dallas, right? I mean, it's sort of, you know, Dallas is a place where, you know, it's utopia. Dallas is utopia if you're a corporation, right? You know, and the New Orleans of the book maybe is utopia if you're a person in touch with your kind of true self. And, so I thought it would just be, I thought it would be fun to play with. And I had to go up there anyway and do a little for some other purposes. And so it was fun to do some research on the ground, like walking around down along the Trinity River and sort of, you know, looking around. And in fact, the Donnie's office, his Dallas office in the book is based pretty closely on a real place I found, you know, like a law office tucked under the I-35 overpass right behind Dealey Plaza. It was pretty awesome.
Were you influenced by Easy Rider?
I was influenced by Easy Rider. That's a very astute observation.
I did some research.
Yeah, you know, Easy Rider, you know, one, it's like, Donnie Chemo is kind of like that Jack Nicholson character in Easy Rider, right? Who's the like ACLU lawyer the guys get locked up with somewhere in redneck land and end up riding with for a while. You know, kind of that kind of like sort of preppy guy who likes to party as hard as, you know, any true head. And sort of the kind of that kind of smart guy who likes to light his brain up with whatever, you know, helpers he can find. Right. And then I was thinking about, you know, what are some good examples of like visits to utopia in more like realist American cinema? Because if you look around for like good utopian stories, they're very hard to find. Most of the kind of most famous utopian stories don't work particularly well as stories, because utopia is kind of like in the Talking Heads song about heaven, you know, a place where nothing ever happens. And they're often more like travelogues, right? You know, it's like they read like tour guides, right? Describing how the system and society is organized. And so Easy Rider has that great kind of scene at the beginning where right after the guys make their big score, right, they go pick up this hitchhiker and they give him a ride back to his commune. And it's super groovy, that commune scene in Easy Rider. And it's very real because it was like filmed at a real commune, I think near Taos or something. And at the end, you know, they're leaving and they look out and they see like the, you know, these young, naive hippies out there, like planting seeds in a pretty scrubby looking field. And the Dennis Hopper character is kind of like, you know, oh, they'll never make it. And then Peter Fonda's Captain America's like, oh, they're going to make it, man. And critics often say that's like the weakest scene in the movie. But to me, it's like, if you didn't have that scene in the beginning of the movie, the ending would not work so powerfully as it does. Because that's kind of like really the place they're trying to get to, even though they think they're driving to like Key West or whatever, right? They're trying to get to a place where, like, a place you'd actually want to live, you know? And it's like us, we're like, we've kind of lost touch of the idea of like a future you would actually want to live in, whether in science fiction or in real life. And so looking at that and like, yeah, like how would you, you know, if you were entrusted with turning your neighborhood into an autonomous zone or turning your town into an autonomous zone, what would you do? You know, how would you design, you know, your own future? Long way of saying that scene was really important in how I kind of thought about the book.
How was the dystopia that you created influenced by our current dystopian society, especially in the last couple of years?
I mean, I work really hard not to be overtly topical in these books. If you do a good job of crafting your science fiction from the material of the observed world, right, from things you see around you, kind of emergent trends and whatever, you may end up, or you're likely to end up seeming prescient. And there are things in these books that seem prescient, like the autonomous zones in this book and the roundups, the like secret police roundups and rule of capture that, you know, we've been seeing going on in places like Portland this summer and other cities. And in Tropic of Kansas, obviously this whole idea of the kind of charismatic CEO becoming an authoritarian president who runs the country like a company, which was all kind of hatched in my head a few years before the current occupant of the White House. But I'm trying to write like actively different from what I see out there. And except to the extent maybe that these Donnie Kimo books is a frustration with the failure of the society we live in to deliver real justice for the wrongs that are committed by the most powerful people. And in particular, the crimes of politicians that are, you know, and politicians being the ones who write the laws have a way of, you know, it's pretty easy for them to exculpate themselves. And politicians of any partisan stripe are always resistant to the idea of criminalizing any of the official acts of any political office holder because they're afraid it might come out to bite them in the butt. But, you know, you think about things like, I mean, like how there's never been any real accountability by American office holders for, you know, illegal bombings on the other side of the world or illegal campaigns of torture or of a lot of the similar things that kind of go on the domestic front. And so I'm exploring in these books those ideas, and in Failed State in particular, like, the idea of an American president being prosecuted for war crimes. And that idea, you know, I suppose is kind of covertly in conversation with real life a little bit, but that kind of principle applies regardless of who holds the office, even if we think the current regime is particularly heinous in that regard. Although there's an argument to be made that they're more like a kind of a lampoon version, and that a lot of the people that came before did a lot more worse things by any kind of objective measure.
The president that you have just necessarily seems like he's kind of more competent than the current orange resident of the White House.
Yeah, he's more of a, he is. He's more of a kind of a traditional, you know, sort of military guy, become successful business person, become, serious office holder who kind
of war hero, right?
Yeah, he's a war hero, and, you know, there were kind of, like, movies made about his, like, escape from the North Koreans or whatever. And he kind of drifts into authoritarianism, you know, based on perceived emergency needs. And, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, as Lord Acton said. So
it sounds like an analysis of all of our presidents, because the current resident isn't the only one that has a sketchy past. So any student of history can find some unusual activities by a lot of our supposedly great presidents.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like suspicious of the whole idea of presidents. I don't really like the idea of bosses. I mean, in my own life, I'm like intrinsically suspicious of any circumstance in which one person is exercising power over another, as opposed to kind of like an arm's length exchange. And, I've worked in lots of corporate environments that, you know, we're all, you know, I mean, which is kind of the real like building block of American society anymore, right? Is this kind of like boss, warlord boss model. And we've been gravitating more and more towards that in our chief executives of the country. And so, yeah, in the world of this
CEO.
Book. Yeah, exactly. The heroic CEO, you know, that really took off, that idea really took off in the 80s with, as more and more individual investors got into the market and, CEOs became more like magazine cover personalities and, you know, then kind of charismatic change agents. And then you go read the business school studies of these kinds of management styles. And usually these charismatic CEOs end up like trashing the company and taking all the money that's left with them.
We were talking to Bijoy Goswami the other day, and he was talking about how at the beginning of America's run, Bijoy knows a lot about the history of the U.S., partly because he had to get a green card, and he really, you know, I mean, when he's doing something, he does it to the hilt, so he really studied that stuff. But he's talking about how originally they did not intend to or want to have another monarch. They didn't want to put a guy in charge, but that didn't work out too well. It was just, and you know, there's this common assumption that if you don't have an executive, that things just won't work. And that's actually one of the interesting challenges of like building a co-op and having a cooperative workplace, is you have to kind of get away from that whole idea. And it's a little bit hard to do because it's so ingrained in everybody's thinking that it's hard for them to adjust to the fact that they might have as much authority as anybody else in the company, you know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And, you know, this kind of patriarchal command and control model goes hand in hand with the idea of the state, with the whole structure that we were talking about earlier, that's, while it has in its modern forms produced, you know, great advancements in, you know, our social welfare and health and in kind of societal resilience, it's also the source of most of our problems. And when you go look at those sorts of human bands that preceded the formation of the first city states, they didn't really, at least according to the, you know, the best anthropological records I've been able to get, studies I've been able to come across, have any like leaders like that. Right. And then you read that and you kind of, you know, they would have like bands of, you know, 50 to 150, maybe 500 people. And they had other kind of systems to figure out what they were going to do. And if you weren't in the business of like dominating and controlling a zone and cramming all the people into one place and figuring out how to divide everything up and to kind of crank up maximum production of what you can suck out of the environment around you, you don't need that kind of a system, right? And so this book is kind of like exploring the idea of whether there are ways you could implement those kinds of ideas in real life. So yeah, it is like a, in the society, the kind of little ecotopia that these people are carving out is a kind of a, it's a kind of a co-op, right?
Yeah, the idea of having a this leader, somebody who's the leader, is that you have somebody who will make the decision so that, you know, you don't have people just sort of dithering constantly about it. But the ideal way to have that kind of leadership, actually the best example I saw of leadership was in a movie called The Thing from Another World, which was made in like 1951.
Uh-huh.
Did you
guys
ever see
are
that?
In the Antarctic base? And
yeah, exactly.
There's a creature from outer space that has crashed in their midst.
Yeah, and there's an Air Force captain. Captain Hendry is sort of like the military guy who has rank. And then there's a bunch of scientists there. So there's also a scientist who has rank, but he's going nuts. Mm-hmm. And Captain Hendry is like one of the great leaders I've seen, because he doesn't like try to think of it himself or tell people what to do. He's constantly being guided by the people who theoretically are his the people that he's in charge of. They're actually, you know, they're figuring things out, and actually they're kind of making the decisions. But he's the guy who says, "Okay, yeah, let's do that." But you don't find that kind of leadership very often. Often when somebody gets into a position of leadership, they start to tell themselves that it means that they're somehow above or better than, you know, the people who supposedly work for them. And they get a lot of feedback to reinforce that thought they have about themselves. And that's,
yeah, well, they get, it's really easy to convince yourself. I mean, I started out my career as a young guy right out of college, and then again, right out of law school, working in the U.S. Senate around these powerful, mostly men. You know, and like politicians are a great example of this, because they have a way of convincing themselves that, you know, of finding the like congruence of the things they believe in and purport to stand for ideologically and their most craven self-interests, right? And they're kind of an ultimate example of another thing that comes with that territory, which is presuming to think that you can make better decisions for other people than the decisions they could make for themselves, right? About what's in their interests. And again, I think those things are necessary fundaments of the kind of system we have. And you know, hacking those things, re-engineering them is a challenging undertaking, but it's one you can, but those are things you can like actually imagine doing, like you can do in your own life with, you know, setting up your business venture as a cooperative rather than a corporation run by a CEO.
One question is like, kind of where do you go with that in terms of the narrative that you've created? And that also gets to the question of like, you had a book deal for two books. So are you going to have a trilogy? Are you going to get another book in this same series?
I don't know if, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, I've talked to my editor and publisher about that, and I think there's interest, and these books have been very well received, I think. And I love telling these stories. And it's fun. I never knew. I mean, I'm a working lawyer as well as a novelist. I never knew that, but I never knew I was interested in lawyer stories until I kind of had this idea. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's an interesting form, and it's an interesting way to deal with a lot of themes and to kind of kind of riff on some established power chords of American storytelling, but hopefully take them in a different direction, right? But I think I'm going to do something different for my next project, maybe something with a heavier kind of a different kind of ecological focus, a little more localized, something almost like eco horror, if you will, which is a kind of a funny term. It's not so much about the horror as about kind of the estrangement of our relationship with nature and the way it can be kind of scary in a way, or intensely different, the otherness of nature. I think it would be fun to tell more stories of this particular lawyer, Donnie Keymore. He's a pretty great character. But these three books kind of work pretty well as a story of that society of, like, you know, before the uprising, during the uprising, and after the uprising. And I'm kind of keen to see what the world looks like on the other side of the pandemic, because if I'm writing into the next part of this future, all science fiction is really about the present, kind of back to Scoob's question about how much these books are, you know, in conversation with the real world dystopia around us. And I think the world on the other side of even this year is, like, so, like, crazily different probably than anything we can even really imagine right now, that I'm sort of curious to, I'm kind of thinking that through in part.
It would really be great to see kind of what governance structures evolve in terms of your narrative and how justice works within, you know, it is that comes next.
I think it is more like communally based. I mean, there's some of that emerging in this book, and I did a lot of, like, deep research for this, digging into the weird field of, like, legal anthropology, where, you know, people have studied, like, the systems of dispute resolution of pre-urban or pre-agricultural societies. And I touch on some of that in the book, but yeah, I think fundamentally it gets to a more, like, cooperative or kind of consensus based system. That's not about the figure of the judge. And I love the idea of imagining kind of the, like, emergent future in the world of that book. That's almost like, how do you become, like, a 22nd century nomad? You know, how do you get people back fully in tune with our own evolutionary nature, and free ourselves from the forced servitude that anybody involved in either urban life or agricultural life is bound to, however pampered a servitude it may be.
That sounds like something I would buy. So I'm looking forward to your future endeavors.
Thank you.
I actually have one last big question.
All right.
What do you think the U.S. is going to look like on November 4th of 2020?
No, man. Well, I mean, a couple of thoughts. One, in terms of the current occupants of the cockpit of power, as it were, after the last election, I remember thinking about how, you know, I mean, I'm also as a corporate lawyer myself, having done a lot of deals with New Yorkers, I was like, oh, these guys are, like, kind of the kind of New York deal guys who, they will fight so hard over every little thing. That's kind of like the business culture style up there. It's just like, fight really hard, scream and yell over, like, inconsequential amounts of money, little points in a contract negotiation, whatever. So I definitely think every step of the way with these guys to win any victory will be hard fought. It's like World War One trench warfare of media politics. by the same token, and I don't discount people who see the authentically authoritarian, maybe even quasi-fascist tendencies of this crowd. I mean, I got to tell you, we went to the beach as a family, to the Texas beach, Port Aransas, for July 4th. And I had never really taken, you know, like, use it, I think the word fascist to describe any kind of anything in American politics is something to be sort of wary of. But the displays I saw on the beach by, like, people in, like, military-grade vehicles with weapons and giant banners proclaiming their political affiliate, I was like, wow, this really is like fascism. And I know all about it because my, you know, my mom and my aunts and uncles and my grandparents all immigrated from Germany after World War II, after living through what happened over there. And I know all about it from their kind of family stories. So I worry about that in very real ways. But I also think that, I mean, that like fantasy version of the past that kind of faction represents is so self-evidently a dinosaur, right? It was a fiction from the get-go. I mean, the privilege that it represents, you know, at the expense of other members of society is not a fiction, but the idea of it having any kind of moral superiority is a fiction. And really the kind of like the great again part of that fantasy is rooted in the anomaly of like the post-World War II reality, where we're the only country left with like a valid viable manufacturing base, right? So of course we had sudden prosperity as we like, you know, rebuilt the world. But so I'm not worried about the long-term future. But if you're asking me who's going to win the election, I don't know. And I don't want to get into the business of predicting for fear of, you know, bad juju, bad medicine. Right. I think the best thing to come out of this, kind of sadly and counterintuitively, is the best and the worst thing is like the knocking down several pegs of American stature in the world. And that's probably good long-term for the world. I mean, we need to get to like more global systems of governance to solve a lot of our planetary problems on a planet of 8 billion people and counting, right? That's probably pretty good, but it's pretty weird living in a country that looks like a failed state to the outside. I mean, I talked to my friends, my son is living in Korea, right? A young adult, and he's just kind of like looking at his homeland from afar, but just like, oh my God. And he was like trying to come back to go to grad school. And now he's like, yeah, maybe I'll stay in Korea for a while. That's like a very telling experience to me of like these, and he and his Korean wife, young Korean wife, they were both like super keen to get back to New York after a year. And now they're just like, I mean, the idea of going back to New York, and I was like, no, thanks. It's like going back to like leaving utopia to go to the world of Soylent Green or something. And I was like, no, thanks.
I read the other day that there's coyotes taking people from America into Mexico. Think about that.
In real life?
Yes. Yes. You can hire somebody to smuggle you into Mexico now, apparently.
I mean, that's like a fictional thing in these books. And no, it was real.
They read your book.
Yeah. I mean, we all kind of daydream on occasion about that, don't we? You know, like, yeah. But I don't, I mean, I think for those of us who have the privilege of being able to still have a kind of middle-class lifestyle here and have standing as professionals, whether as lawyers or as business people or as thought leaders in the media or whatever, you kind of have a duty to stick around and keep trying to build a better world, better future for your kids and your grandkids.
Well, back in the era of the America Love It or Leave It bumper stickers, there was a bumper sticker that said, America, fix it or fuck it. And I guess I still want to fix it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know. I definitely have my fuck it days, too.
Well, thanks, Chris. Actually, this has been a great, great interview.
Can't wait for the next book.
Oh, yeah.
We're wrapping up just as the thunder and lightning has descended here over the airstream. Very exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thanks for, I appreciate that, guys. Yeah, and I'll keep you posted on that. And it's always fun to talk to y'all.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.